This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi again, and welcome to New Books and Latino Studies, a channel within the New Books Network. I am your host, Tiffany Gonzalez. Today on the program, we have Dr. Sonia Hernandez, an associate professor in the Department of History at Texas A&M University, and Dr. John Moran Gonzalez, a professor of American English Literature at the University of Texas at Austin. They are my guest on today's podcast, and they will talk about their new anthology, Reverberations of Racial Violence, Critical Reflections on the History of the Border. And if my listeners are wondering, you can purchase the edited anthology from UT Press's website, where they also offer discounted rates. Bienvenidos, and welcome to the New Books in Latino Studies. Thanks for taking the time to chat with me today. How's everyone doing?
Hi, Tiffany. Thank you for having us.
Yes, great to be here.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited. So a typical style that I really like to start off any of these conversations is kind of getting y'all to talk about yourselves, about your upbringing, your personal and professional background. Sonia, why don't you start?
Thank you for that question, Tiffany. It's a pleasure to be here with you and everyone else listening in. Well, I'm from the Rio Grande Valley, and so there's obviously a personal connection for me, not only with respect to reverberations of racial violence, but also in just my other works. So I am interested in the intersections of gender and labor in the U.S.-Mexican borderlands region, broadly speaking, for the most part, late 19th century and the first part of the 20th century. And I'm also interested in, especially now as I've been involved with Refusing to Forget, which I'm sure we will talk about in a little bit, just the role of the state in encouraging, in participating in violence through its numerous agents, like the Texas Rangers and other members of law enforcement, with respect to the Mexican origin community, and also looking at it from a gender and more transnational or greater Norteño context, if you will. And so that's newer work that I'm doing right now. But my first book, dealt with looking at women's labor contributions in Nuevo León, Tamaulipas, and South Texas during the Porfiriato and up through the Mexican Revolution period and the decades following the revolution, and looking at forms of labor activism, which then led me to finish this new book entitled For a Just and Better World, that looks at anarchist expressions within an emerging feminist movement in the port of Tampico, with connections to other ports of entry and certainly across Texas in the 1920s and 1930s.
So like Sonia, I'm grew up in the lower Rio Grande Valley in Brownsville specifically. and really came to my field of Latino, Latina, Latinx literature through a somewhat roundabout way. I first started off looking at post-Reconstruction national allegories, and included a chapter on Maria Amparo Ruiz de Burton, so looking at California in the 19th century. But then that became my second book. But my first book was about the emergence of Mexican American literature during the 1930s, as a counter discourse to the Texas Centennial at the time in 1936. So really with that work, I was looking at the way Mexican American intellectuals responded to the aftermath of this earlier period and the violence directed towards Mexican origin folks at that time. And so I look at this period as one in which writers are looking for an alternative strategy to protect civil rights, and at the same time linking the creation of this literature to a social movement, right? So in other words, the literary aspect was but one dimension of a much larger kind of movement to for civil rights that became embodied and institutionalized by the League of United Latin American Citizens, or LULAC. So, and from there, I've gone on to edit a number of critical reference anthologies about Latinx literature. And with Refusing to Forget, I'm beginning to cultivate an interest in the kind of environmental dimensions suggested by that.
Thanks for sharing. It really seems, I mean, from both of y'all, from the RGV or South Texas, for those listening, and for myself, someone that comes from Texas, we know these histories from when they're passing down from oral histories, especially the histories that you write about in this anthology and you're producing for the public. But given that y'all are from the region of South Texas or the Rio Grande Valley, why this particular story? How did this come about? I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit why this particular topic in particular. John, you want to start off with that?
Sure. I mean, I think first off, it really is worth mentioning that I didn't learn about these stories growing up. And even though I'm from there, right? I mean, all my K through 12 education was in the Valley, but never did I hear about such incidents, except potentially in passing in references to the bandit wars, a kind of far off and largely forgotten kind of incident. But, you know, it didn't seem anything that was relevant to my daily life or that of my family. And so I really didn't learn of these things until graduate school. And so I wondered why didn't I know about this? Why weren't there any, why wasn't this taught in the public schools? Why wasn't this otherwise commemorated? Because as we know, these were incredibly formative moments for the region. And so really it was stemming out of that question, why have we forgotten collectively? And of course, this does not apply to the scholars and of course the descendants, familial descendants who have always kept this memory alive. I mean it in terms of a generally known fact at the level of public discourse that is acknowledged as having a great impact, as well as, of course, being a great injustice.
I would have to agree with John with respect to not being exposed to sort of the full history related to this dark chapter in our state's history, the 1910-1920 period. Although I remember growing up, listening to some of the corridos that, or Mexican folk ballads that my father would play on like Sunday afternoons when we were barbecuing as a family. And, you know, for example, like El Corrido de los Tequileros that deals with the Prohibition era, you know, border issues, and El Corrido de Gregorio Cortez, the ballad of Gregorio Cortez. And I remember my father talking about Los Rinches, right, as the Mexican origin community, you know, that was the term used by the community whenever they were talking about the Texas Rangers. And so I had sort of gone a little bit in terms of what I would later discover being a pretty notorious history related to the Texas Rangers. But in terms of, you know, the in-depth histories of state violence and of, you know, of the fact that these state agents were not, you know, these rogue agents acting on their own, that the fact that they followed in many cases orders from up above, leading all the way to the governor, you know, that fuller account, I wasn't exposed to that until much, much later in grad school. And certainly, you know, during my you know, early participation with Refusing to Forget, especially after being introduced to some of the descendants through Professor Monica Munoz Martinez, who had collaborated with several families who had confided in her and shared their personal archives in attempts to keep that that those histories alive, as John pointed out to earlier.
Yeah, y'all are absolutely correct. And that's for someone being trained in Texas, right, through literature and the production of this anthology and becoming well known with Dr. Monica Munoz's work, right, The Injustice Never Leaves You. This is how we, the public, right, even their communities have learned about these injustices of state-sanctioned violence going on in the early 20th century. Why is it, do you think, that these histories have been omitted or overlooked of this racial violence against Mexicanos?
Well, if I may, going back to the Canales hearings back in the spring of 1919 that exposed the indiscriminate way in which the Rangers, you know, participated in atrocities, you know, committed against the predominantly Mexican origin population. You know, going back to 1919, those transcripts were supposed to be made public, but it was, you know, frankly, it was quite embarrassing. The state would obviously not want this to be part of the official record because it really exposed the Rangers for, you know, for what they were. And basically they were a terror organization, and there's plenty of evidence. And we can just look back to the 1600 pages that comprise that Canales hearing. And so this is obviously, you know, something that, was not only, you know, hidden and silenced, but that the total opposite would happen in terms of celebrating the Rangers as part of the, you know, the true and only history of the founding of Texas. And so the entire opposite happens, you know, certainly by the 20s and 30s. And there's a sort of celebration of Texan identity and the Texas story of, you know, of growth and development having to do with the Rangers, and but the Rangers as these heroes, not as, you know, agents of terror. Particularly racial terror.
So I very much agree with what how Sonia just laid it out. And I would add that one other aspect of it was that one of the reasons this information was buried, really, was because in the moment, it did represent a profound embarrassment for the state, in the sense that it made Texas look like the Wild West, you know, and with agents, you know, seemingly acting independently of central authority and, you know, more like vigilantes than proper state agents who engaged in due process. And so, of course, they had tacit approval to do what they did. But nonetheless, the kind of narrative was that, you know, Texas could no longer afford to look like a backwards state, right? It was bad for business, bad for its image. And so, it was a big PR problem. So the response was to simply bury it. You know, more long term. Well, really, I think even as it was this kind of PR problem in the short term, it also was about ensuring that the legitimacy of these actions, that is, of the results, would stand, right? Rather than having them be continuously challenged by the illegitimacy of the way things turned out, you know, these also had to be suppressed in order to, you know, legitimate what had happened, what had occurred as a result. And so that is the kind of disenfranchisement and terror unleashed against the communities, Mexican communities, were part, a structural part of continuing white supremacy in the region. And so you couldn't completely delegitimate it. It had a, you know, a useful state function, as it were. Hence it disappears from any public school curricula. There is a general decades-long underdevelopment of higher education, mostly because the business interests of the region, you know, don't want an educated workforce. They don't need it. They don't want it. And so I think both in the short term and in the long term, it was in the interests of the states and corporate interests and white supremacy to make sure these facts never saw the light of day.
I totally agree with that. I mean, knowing these stories creates a spark that I firmly believe within communities, within educators, within professors such as yourselves, researchers, and that spark is what led to, I believe, knowing y'all both, refusing to forget, is if that's correct. Now, I would like to know a little bit more of that background. How did that spark of knowing, of researching these histories and trying to teach these histories in universities in Texas, how did refusing to forget originate? Sonia, can you start off with that discussion for me?
Sure, yes. Thanks for that question. So, you know, refusing to forget, which is a public history, you know, nonprofit organization project. It started out as an idea, as a collaboration. Some of us had been planning, going back to 2010 here, some of us had been planning events, you know, conferences on the centennial of the Mexican Revolution. I remember inviting our RTF colleague, Dr. Ben Johnson, and Dr. Trini Gonzalez to speak on the events around the Mexican Revolution along the border. I don't really remember when you and I started talking, John, but by 2013, 2014, we all met in a San Antonio Knox Tejas Vocal Conference, and we began to talk about how best to hold, organize public events that took into account the voices and the histories and the goals of many of the descendants of the victims of the 1910-1920 period of violence. This is where we also began to converse with Dr. Monica Munoz Martinez, who had been in conversation with many of these families as she was writing her book, The Injustice Never Leaves You, at that time. And we began to plan on how to best mark these upcoming centennials, the centennial of the Mexican Revolution, the centennial of the Canales hearings, of first state-led investigation into Texas Ranger violence, which then, you know, eventually led to a major exhibit at the Bob Bullock History Museum, and then the NEH-sponsored conference, which then led to this anthology that we're talking about today. So it sort of happened, in a very rather quickly, but we always sort of, going back to your question about, you know, why we wanted to do this, and we wanted to honor the voices and the memories of those who had, who lost their lives during this period in our state's history. And we also wanted to validate the efforts of the descendants of those victims, of families who made it, a point to preserve those family archives and to not forget. They refused to forget what had happened to their loved ones, many of whom never got to bury their loved ones. There was no real closure in the form of a funeral, of some kind of gathering, in many cases, not until the gatherings, again, going back to these public events that we organized, it wasn't until some of these families got together at historical marker unveilings, as in the case of the historical marker that we unveiled back in 2018, pre-COVID here. The families of the Longoria and the Bazan families came together with other community residents and educators and students. And of course, Refusing to Forget was there. And that was for many of them, I mean, that was the only moment or the first moment where they actually came together to reflect upon those, horrific murders. All this to say that Refusing to Forget has made it a central objective to honor the voices of the stories of the victims and the voices and the efforts of the family, the descendants of those victims.
And since Sonia has covered the origins of RTF so well, I'm just going to add something about the context of the moment in which we were coming together in 2013, 2014. And because it very much relates to the title of the anthology, the Reverberations of Racial Violence part. And the reverberation was occurred back then, a century ago, was occurring now. It was still occurring. And 2013, 2014, this is the moment of Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, and Sandra Bland. And it was the incarceration of kids in Yeleras, right, along in detention centers along the border. So what we saw was this kind of continuance, as it were, or this echo of state violence against communities of color that really, I think, prompted us to move from where we were in our academic work, right, to move this to a larger public forum and sphere of discussion. Because scholars have known about these incidents for decades and have written about it. But once again, it seemed to me the whole mission of Refusing to Forget was to bring these incidents back to public consciousness and therefore dialogue about it at a larger level beyond the ivory tower.
I agree. And bringing this to the public forum, I'm wondering, John, was there any pushback from the public? I know that y'all did an exhibit in collaboration with the Bullock Museum there in Austin, Texas. But I'm wondering what did the public have to say, or was it just smooth sailing from there on once it was brought to the public in that type of presentation, public-facing presentation?
Absolutely. The exhibit, Life and Death on the Border, 1910 to 1920, ran for the first 3 months of 2016 at the Bob Bullock State History Museum here in Austin. And the reception was really fantastic. I mean, we had worked as historical consultants and experts with the great staff and director of the Bullock Museum, who were quite eager to stage this. And we had anticipated there might be some negative reaction from certain quarters. To be truthful, that never really materialized. But I have a couple of thoughts about as to why not. Well, because I think if this had been held even a year later, right, in 2017, we might have gotten a much different reception. And of course, I'm alluding to the way who was elected president in fall of 2016. So, but the other thing that I think, though, the reaction, though, that we most received, and I think we were certainly most gratified by, was that of descendants, that of community members who were incredibly thankful that this story had finally been told, right? Or that they finally became aware of this story. And it's the sort of thing that I think the kind of question of racialized state violence has always been of concern to communities of color, even if they didn't have specific encounters of this within their families, right? Or you know, there was always a kind of generalized fear. And I think what the exhibit did was people were able to kind of point to, like, oh, this is why this is why we're always, cautious around the cops. You know, this is why we've got a fear of law enforcement. And because there was a kind of generational trauma, you know, it was passed down. Even as it was reinforced by actual lived encounters. So I think communities were grateful the story was being told, to be able to kind of name why this fear was there. And I think also as a potential avenue for seeking recognition of this injustice from the state.
So knowing these histories in public facing, and knowing that Texas history is a requirement in the state of Texas, even in middle school, not just in higher ed, but I'm wondering, has there been pushback in higher ed, you know, in college classroom, from both of y'all teaching these histories, from students that, you know, perhaps have been so prideful of knowing they're heroes of Texas history, but now knowing this state-sanctioned violence kind of criticizes or pushes back on this heroic narrative of the Texas Rangers. Has there been any changes within teaching this history, this new history, to those students?
If I may, in my classes, you know, both undergrad and grad level, I haven't witnessed, you know, in intense resistance to this history. But one of the things that I usually do before I cover this material is I say, when I'm done lecturing, I will share my opinion with you on these matters. But I'm going to talk to you about these moments in our history from a factual, evidence-based perspective. And I think when students see, because I share excerpts from the Canales hearings, and I also alert them to the fact that these hearings have been digitized and they're available through the Texas State Archives website. And so it's really difficult to argue, when you have so much evidence in front of you. And I think it's also important to talk about the complexities of when we talk about, you know, Ranger violence, for example. I mean, there are other forms of state violence, but let's just focus on Ranger abuse of power. And so when you share with students, you know, with evidence, right, with source material about how one Ranger could walk into a courthouse and go into the chambers of a circuit judge in Falfurrias, Texas, during this time period, and pistol butt or pistol whip, I should say, a judge in that manner for complaining about how this particular Ranger had taken two Mexican prisoners from the jail cell to take matters into his own hand. When that could happen, it's pretty, number one, it just makes you think of what that Ranger could do with an ordinary resident. And number two, it also shows how, you know, in this case, we are focusing on ethnic Mexicans as the community hit hardest during this time period. But we can also point to examples of how non-Mexicanos also faced violence at the hands of Texas Rangers. So when we confront this history in that way, that look, there is plenty of evidence that for the longest time was silenced and was hidden. It's really difficult to argue. At least that's been my experience. And you'll find, students just like, you know, folks from the community or from, you know, that may attend these public talks or, you know, that send you the occasional email saying, you know, this is just, a whole bunch of lies. You know, you're going to get that once in a while. But I think, at least it's been my experience, that the majority of folks who are exposed to this history in this way, that, you know, it's grounded in substantial, you know, evidence of all sorts, right, including also oral histories, that it is, it's just so difficult to refuse. It's so difficult to argue against that. That would be, again, that's based on my experience teaching this material in my classes.
I would just add that because I'm a literature scholar and not a historian, I don't have a course, you know, that is, as it were, structured about history per se. Yes, I do literary history, but it's very much as how experience is mediated through text, through, you know, and through aesthetics. So, and while I do at times talk about these matters, I am very much, you know, it's not, as it were, the kind of mainstay of what I teach in the classroom. And so I can't say that I've gotten, the general reaction from students when I have taught this material has been, why didn't we know about this before? Not a kind of, anger about it. So, yeah, so that's been my experience.
It's hard.
If I may, just quickly, Tiffany.
Absolutely.
I think it's now we're faced with a real, problem, just an unfortunate situation with respect to the K-12 system, right? With these laws that are not or have really nothing to do with CRT, with critical race theory, but have all to do with censoring educators in telling these more inclusive histories that reflect, that I believe should reflect, the real demographics of the state. So it's a different situation. It's a much more challenging situation for K-12 educators than for those of us in higher ed. And who knows, right? I mean, that may change given the politics that we face now, educational politics, if you will. But it's a much more challenging situation for our colleagues in the K-12 system. But this is history that, I mean, goodness, if our children are young enough to experience racism, why shouldn't they read about it in such a way that is a constructive manner that will help them better understand contemporary issues, contemporary challenges? You cannot do that in a vacuum. Everything has a history. Everything has a longer lineage.
And if I might editorialize as well for just a moment, one of the great ironies is the recent found concern by politicians over educational material that may cause discomfort to them. Well, nobody was really concerned about the discomfort of students of color for decades when they were being taught racist and sexist material in the school system. Nobody apparently cared about that, or not enough.
Y'all are speaking some truth today, and I really enjoy it because it's true. As John, as you so nicely ended that, was that nobody really worried about what students of color and their lived experiences and their family, this generational trauma, right, of why they weren't being taught their histories in K-12 or in college until recently, with y'all's work and the work for the past 20 years from other Chicano Latino scholars that are bringing injustices to light. And I really, I just want to thank y'all for the continued work that y'all are doing with Refusing to Forget, for bringing forth this anthology. I know it must have taken so much time and effort and away from your families, to produce these histories and these communities to rectify the injustices of what has been done in Texas towards Mexicanos, Tejanos. We're towards the end of our episode, and I have so many more questions. But then if I ask all the questions, what will the readers then have left to read? But I want to thank you, Dr. Sonia Hernandez and Dr. John Moran Gonzalez, for being on this episode today of Latino Studies for the New Books Network. And to my listeners, thank you for listening to this episode, which featured Dr. Hernandez and Dr. Moran Gonzalez. Hasta la próxima.